Hello, everyone, and welcome to Daughter Talk. I'm your host today. My name is Christopher Constantino, and I'm an assistant professor and speech-language pathologist at Florida State University. This is episode 705, and I'm talking with Dr. John Jackson. Dr. Jackson is a family doctor in rural Nebraska. Thank you for coming on, Dr. Jackson.
Hi. Thank you for having me. And it's a pleasure and an honor to be able to be on this show.
Yeah. Dr. Jackson contacted me a couple days ago, and we had a really interesting conversation on the telephone. And I think I'd like to start today's episode by just asking you if you could share that part of your story with the listeners.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, anyways, as I said, I'm a family doctor, and I'm in a practice in a town of about 5,000 people, and I do pretty much everything from surgery to ER to delivering babies, and I'm like the old-fashioned traditional doctor. My path to become a physician at times has not been easy. When I was a second-year medical student, the chairman of family medicine, who perhaps like chairman for like 2 years, and she called me in after I had given a presentation, and I thought she was going to call me in and tell me what a marvelous job I had done. But no, she called me in and she said that the medical school had made a mistake in accepting me, because that she felt that patients would not come and see a doctor who stuttered. She also felt that when I became a third and fourth year medical student, and when I was to go on clinicals, that my fellow students would despise me, because I would be slowing down their learning. She offered me that, she said they could refund my money, and she strongly advised me to choose another profession. Right. I asked her, I said, "Are you throwing me out of school?" I said, I wish you would have told me this 2 years ago, because I had been accepted into five other schools of medicine. And she said that she understood that it may hurt, but she felt this was the best thing for me and for the school. And I informed her that since I was passing everything, that I didn't think she really had that type of authority. And I laughed, and I went to the dean's office, and the dean told me no, that she could not toss me out of school. And the dean even told me that he actually knew other doctors who like stuttered and were very, very, very successful. One of the things this chairman of family medicine did 2 years later, when I was applying for internships, she sent letters to every single place I'm in the state of Michigan, basically saying that I would not be a good doctor. And so I ended up practicing doing my internship. I'm in the South Bronx. I'm in an inner city ghetto, poor hospital, and it was of perhaps the best training that I could ever hope for, and I actually learned and saw a lot. Okay, there are times when I often like wonder, you know, I mean, if I would not have been as strong willed, and if I would have listened to her, you know, where would I be now? Okay, where I am now, here, my entire career has always been serving the poor, serving the underserved, serving people who do not have a doctor. And it's interesting because from the minute that I started like practicing, and even now, you know what, to get into see me, it's a 2 to 4 week waiting list. And I have always been an incredibly busy doctor. We're also here, you know, and this has always been always my policy. I see everybody, and I see everybody who comes in the door without of looking at insurances or of ability to pay. So I mean, I am kind of like the doctor that everybody comes to see. So anyways, that was basically I'm an introduction to like me overall.
Yeah, I think that's a great introduction. And there's so much in that story that we could talk about. I think the first thing and the biggest thing that jumps in to my head is that I think a lot of people who stutter probably relate to your experience of somebody in authority or somebody in power telling them that they couldn't do something because of the way that they talked. And I'm curious as to why you think you were able to respond with such resilience, and if you have any advice for listeners who might find themselves in that situation, how they could find that same resilience.
Okay. Well, you know, when I was young, one thing that my parents always did is this, is that they never viewed stuttering as a handicap. That if I wanted something, that I mean, I was told, you know, that you have to be the one that asks for it. You know what I mean? I can remember being about maybe 5, and we were at a restaurant, and they put cheese on my burger, but when I'd ordered just a regular burger, and my father said, you know what? Hey, if you want the cheese taken off the burger, you do it, not me. And so, I mean, I was always like reared to just charge straight ahead. And I think that my parents built up my self-esteem. Okay, and like they never have allowed me to view it as something to stop me from doing something. Okay, I do think that things, and perhaps, well, that things in of medicine have actually gotten better, okay? You know what I mean? I mean, I can tell you when I was on surgery as a third and fourth year medical student that I had many, many surgeons who would just belittle me and to put me down. Now, medicine has changed and of education does not tolerate that anymore. I also think that people are just sometimes ignorant, you know, and I don't, you know, and I mean, I think that maybe a part of all of our jobs is to educate people, you know. A question that came up, and I would like to tell you also this, because I do surgery a lot, okay, people have asked me of how do you not stutter in surgery. Well, you know what though, whenever I like walk into a code or to something that is a of crisis setting, the first thing that I always do is I take a deep breath, count to 5, and it seems to calm everybody down plus myself. And it's, you know, what's interesting is this, is that the staff will tell you, they always know if somebody is incredibly ill because they say, you are incredibly fluent when you like walk into a crashing situation. So we all know if Dr. Jackson's stuttering, things are okay. If he's not stuttering, that's the time for us to be running and checking up on everything.
I like that a lot, that your stuttering adds a level of expressiveness to your interactions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think your stuttering has benefited your clinical practice?
Well, you know, what's interesting is this, is that, I mean, we'll hear about a third of my patients do not speak English. They are the undocumented workers that come here and do all the bottom like jobs. And so I'm incredibly like conscious about making sure they understand what I'm saying. I also think also this is that, that when I do have patients, especially like children who stutter, that I tend to relate to them. But I also, I'm incredibly of encouraging that you can still go forward. Don't use this as an excuse for not being successful. And yes, at times it's going to be harder. All right. But I still think that you can still go forward with it. I am the advocate for the underserved. Because you know what I mean, that there have been numerous times in my career where I have been treated like somebody who didn't know anything.
Yeah, so you've had those experiences, and your experiences maybe with stuttering and being mistreated help you relate to your patients on a deeper level.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. Well, you know, and I'll tell you, it's also interesting is that, you know what I mean? I mean, I am incredibly big upon being compassionate and kind and caring. And I guess maybe it's because I've had people being the opposite towards me.
Right. Have you always... Do you think had a positive attitude around your stuttering, or is that something that you had to grow into? Was it more difficult at other times in your life?
Well, you know what, though, there were times as a teenager when it actually was more difficult. You know what I mean? It was also times when you know what, though, it does hurt when people laugh at you. And it does hurt when they say very, 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 very negative things. When I went to speech camp back in 1979, and when I saw other people with other more serious speech problems, I think that I stopped feeling sorry for myself, and really wanted to just move on. And I also thought that, you know what, we need people that are dedicating to helping others.
So is that where your inspiration to be a doctor started?
Well, you know, my father's a doctor, or he, okay. You know, I'm of, and of, but you know what, though? I mean, I think it has like helped me focus more on the underserved and more on of helping people who are the forgotten people in our society. Now, here is something that I guess that I found is also this. I have a master's in tropical medicine from the University of Liverpool in England. Okay, and that when I was in England, because like part of defending your thesis and of getting your certificate in tropical medicine, they actually like put you through like a 8 hours of an oral exam, and the British seem to be so much more accepting and so much more patient than whenever I've had like exams here, you know. And you know, I mean, and that they were also more relaxing. And even though it's an intense thing, I found that they also listened better.
That's interesting, and I think it points to the importance that we're never talking. I mean, sometimes we are, but usually we aren't talking to ourselves, right? That communication is always social, and it takes two people to engage. And so your stuttering and how it feels when you're stuttering is impacted by the people you're talking to and their reactions as well as your own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, one thing too that I found very, very, very interesting, medicine overall is very ignorant when it comes to stuttering. And I have, I have educated my colleagues, okay? But I mean, I still get people that come and ask me, what trauma happened to you at three or four years old to cause you to stutter? And I'm like, nothing. You know, I was a happy 3-year-old child.
Yeah, that's a persistent observation, I think, from speech language pathologists, that other fields tend to not be up to date on stuttering. It seems like the prevailing advice from a lot of pediatricians is just ignore it and it'll go away, which was the advice given back in the 40s, but it's since we've since realized that it doesn't go away, and it's okay to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, my father, general practice, he essentially told my mom for years, it'll be fine. And it wasn't until I was 16, my mother finally said, you know what? It's not fine. You know what? It's starting to affect his life. And that was when I went off to speech camp.
Was there anybody else who stuttered in your family?
My mother did up until the age of, I think, 11 or 12. Okay. And then, you know what I mean? I was interested in the genetics of this. And it was, well, anyways, we found that my great grandfather, there was some documentation in a diary where he had times where he could not talk straight.
That's really interesting evidence that you had diary entries, because oftentimes when we're talking to families about whether they have any history of stuttering, how people talk isn't always passed down, right? After somebody passes away, we don't write down all their speech impediments, right? So those things tend to disappear from the record. But having diary entries lends a very intimate view to your ancestor's life.
Yeah, you know what? So I found that to be interesting.
Right. So how did you go from your residency in the South Bronx to rural Nebraska?
Well, you know, when I finished my family medicine residency, I actually looked for the poorest town in the poorest state. So my first 4 years, I was in practice in rural Arkansas in the deep, deep South. And it was interesting because, you know what I mean, people there still had a heavy, heavy Southern accent. So, I mean, I was just known as the Yankee doctor. And after that, you know, I did a surgical fellowship in obstetrics, and from then I went to practice up in Appalachia, okay, and I was in rural Appalachia for 4 years, and then I went and I did my master's in tropical medicine because I was thinking about going to West Africa and being a refugee camp doctor. And an opportunity opened up here in rural Nebraska. And I was only going to stay a year. But, I mean, I've been here now for, 16 years, I think. Okay? And in between times, I mean, I have worked on Indian reservation, and I also like worked in the Northwest. But I mean, we are in rural Nebraska, and as I said, that I am one of few doctors that will see the undocumented workers because they get sick too. They have babies. And we've always had an open door policy. We see everybody that comes in the door.
Your description of seeing everyone and everything, as somebody who has really specialized into something, right? Like I've my education and my career path has been one of drilling deeper into a very specific area, right? And so when I see clients, I'm seeing stuttering, right? Like I know what to expect for the most part. I know what I'm going to be working with. But listening to you talk, it's like there has to be such an element of unpredictability to your work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, there is. You know what? I mean, especially this, you know what I mean? I have a patient that is 5 days old and I have a patient that's 105 years old. Well, and everything in between. And we are never sure what is going to like come in that day.
Do you enjoy that aspect of the job?
Oh, yes. You know what I mean? I wouldn't be anything else but a physician. And it's also nice because that whenever I think back to that chairman of family medicine, you know what I mean? I have delivered over 5,000 babies. And so where would those 5,000 babies be if I wasn't here?
You've had a significant impact on a great number of people's lives.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you also this, you know what I mean? I enjoy my job, and a lot of times we have a lot of fun. Sometimes it's sad, but I mean, overall, I like to think that we are making a good impact on people's lives.
I want to circle back to some of the predictions that woman you made about you becoming a doctor and why it was a bad idea. Obviously, you've developed a successful practice and are doing well. But did any of those predictions act as stumbling blocks along the way? Was she right about anything?
Well, you know, what I thought was interesting is this, is that, yes, they were a few of attendings when I was in training who were just jerks. And, but I mean, I wasn't the only one they were like jerks to. When I came out here, oh, it must have been my first or second year in practice, and I had a patient who was suffering a bad heart attack. And I called our referral hospital in Omaha, and their ER doctor told me, go and find somebody that can talk right to me. And I used some very, very choice words to him, hung up, and I just called another hospital who did accept our patient. The next day, our administrator came in and said, hey, I understand that you hung up on our ER doctor. You know, I'm in Omaha. And I told her exactly what happened. And she was furious. And within an hour, that ER doctor was calling me up and apologizing. Okay. So, I mean, every now and then I do get some of that. But you know what, though? I mean, I have like colleagues who are from other countries. And like they have like told me they also every now and then get something similar because that they speak with an accent. Okay. My fellow students, never ever happened. You know what I mean? I was always the one they always wanted to be paired with because they always knew that I was a very, very, very hard working person. So I mean, I would not dump on them. Okay. I also had, and I thought this was interesting, a lot of medical education is like done in group settings. Okay. And that can be nervous because they'll go right down the line. And I mean, I had a couple of attendings who would call me in their office and say, okay, tell me what you know about hepatitis. Or like, tell me what you know about this. And it was such a better of experience. And I later like found out that those guys did that to everyone. They felt one-on-one was a better way of teaching medicine than one-on-seven.
So it sounds like there have been bumps along the way, but that her assessment was largely incorrect, that not only did you not, were you not only were you an effective doctor, but that other doctors, for the most part, and your fellow students accepted you gladly.
Well, you know, when I did my surgical fellowship, when I interviewed, because I'd interviewed at three other places. But the last place that I interviewed, way up in like Washington State, their number one concern was, can you handle being on call for 36 hours on and 12 off? And I said, well, you know, when I was in Arkansas, I said I was on call 24/7. And that was their main emphasis. And when I was there, I mean, I set a record for the number of surgical cases actually done. And everybody spoke incredibly highly of me, all right? I think that sometimes you can get people who think that a physician or a person should be a certain way, and maybe they become uncomfortable when someone doesn't fit into their model of what a doctor or a teacher or say anybody should actually be. I mean, I've always told everybody, look at my results. You know what I mean? I can go up with anybody. And also this, the majority of my patients will like tell you, Dr. Jackson listens. And the other, you know what, and the other doctors we have been to, they don't listen. He does.
in addition to teaching the stuttering class at my university, I also teach the counseling class, and that's what I'm teaching this semester. And with my students, we were just looking at some of the medical literature on listening, and a doctor who patients feel is listening to them gets better results than a doctor who patients feel isn't. Right? And there was a number of reasons for that in terms of the patients are better able to describe their symptoms, so the doctor is better able to make a diagnosis. The patients are better able to voice concerns about treatment options, so you know, compliance is less of an issue, and treatments that correspond to the patient's goals and needs are better addressed. But the bottom line was that listening is a critical part of practice.
Yes, it is. Very.
I'm wondering if for any listeners out there who are feeling like they can't or stuttering is going to make whatever it is they want to do harder, what would you say to them?
Well, you know what? I think you have to keep on charging forward. But here, one of the things is this, is I'm a Civil War buff. Okay. And about maybe 15, 20 years ago, I came across this short story. There was a Union admiral named Admiral Frederick. Okay. Admiral Frederick was the one, he was a very, very brilliant admiral. And that he's the one that took New Orleans from the South, and he took Mobile Bay, and just a brilliant admiral. Well, anyways, the interesting thing is this, is that he suffered from severe vertigo, meaning dizziness, whenever he got on a ship. And yet this guy's profession was to be an admiral. So admirals, they're always on ships. And the way that he actually overcame it was during battles, this guy would have his men tie him to a pole and to like lock his head so he could only see like straight ahead. And that was his way of overcoming vertigo. So you know what, though? I mean that when it comes to our stuttering, keep charging ahead. You know what? And I do think that part of our job is educating people, you know? And I think if you really absolutely want something, it doesn't matter what anybody says. You know what I mean? I would have stopped as a second-year student. And if I would have listened to the chairman of family medicine. And
I love...
Yeah, all right.
Go on. I want to hear where you were going. Sorry for interrupting.
Oh, that's okay. And I'll tell you, you know what? And it's interesting because, I mean, I have given this person who later went on to become a dean of a medical school... medical school, you know what I mean? I've given her an opportunity to admit she was wrong, but she never has. So maybe that tells me something about her character. And it also tells me something also about mine.
Right. That a lot of times when you're being mistreated for your speech, it has less to do with your stuttering and more to do with the other person.
Yeah, I think so too.
I love the image you just described of the admiral tied to his ship so that he could perform his duty. And what's fascinating about it is that it required the help of his crew, right? Like they had to, one, tie him up, and two, trust that that this bizarre situation was going to be all right, right? And so I think it speaks volumes to, one, we can do whatever we set our minds to, but two, it's okay to lean on other people too, and let them in on what we're going through. And more often than not, they're helpful.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. Well, you know, what's interesting too, and you know what is with that Civil War story, he was the one where his first two ships got blown up in line and his men like shouted out, there are torpedoes ahead. What should we do? And he looked up and gave that famous reply, damn the torpedoes, full steam ahead. And I guess that's always been my philosophy. You know what? Full steam ahead, guys. And you will find people that are kind and will help and will be supportive.
Right. It's also a particularly apt metaphor for a lot of what we do in stuttering therapy, where a lot of people who come to therapy are using a lot of speech behaviors that are moving them backwards, right? So they're restarting their words over and over again, or restarting their sentences. And something I talk to my clients about is, I want you to always be thinking about moving forward through your speech, right? That if you find yourself moving backwards, that you've prevented yourself from finishing what you were trying to say. I'd rather you get stuck and move forward than move backwards. And so I think as sort of a motivational image, it's helpful, but also in terms of what we're doing when we're speaking and stuttering, I think it's also a good metaphor.
Yeah. I think so too.
Dr. Jackson, I've been really enjoying this conversation. You have a fascinating story, and I think it's an inspiring one too for a lot of people. Do you have any hopes for what you might do in the future?
Well, you know what? We just found out that we are pregnant again. So we are going to be raising my third daughter. And I will also tell you also this, I still have some dreams about going to West Africa. You know, however, I know that people need us here. You know, because there's no one else to take care of these people here.
Yeah. Congratulations on the coming of your third daughter. How old are your other two?
16 and 13.
Okay. Was there any stuttering? Did they experience any stuttering?
My 13-year-old did, I think, in second or third grade, but we got her into therapy, and she's as fluent as anything now. And she was in therapy for about 6 months.
Okay. Did you feel prepared for that as a parent, having gone through it yourself?
Yes. And I think that the main thing was to get her into therapy fast and not just wait.
Right. Okay. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I'm going to give you the last word. If you could tell future doctors anything about stuttering, what would it be?
Okay, one, listen. Two, I do think we have to get these kids into therapy earlier. You know what? You shouldn't have to wait until you're 16. Okay. Three, I also think, you know what, talk to the parents, because a lot of parents, like my mom, felt guilt for years. You know what, that it was something she did wrong, or maybe there was something in parenting she did wrong, okay? And I think that to like the people out there, especially like the children, keep moving forward.
I think that's an excellent message. Thank you for talking with us today, Dr. Jackson.
Pleasure.